God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Feel free to unmute and just give us your first name, if you'd be so bold. Or you could just wave at the camera and we'll say hello. Anybody? First 30 days? All righty then. Brother Al, would you read the preamble, please? I'll put that on the screen.
All right, Al Alcoholic.
Yeah.
Sobriety date, May 5th, 1987. AA works, it really does. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, sir. All righty. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to have Marilyn S. To share tonight. After she tells her story, we'll around the top of the hour, we'll take a short break and call for the seventh tradition. If there's time, we'll ask for some announcements, and then we'll reconvene and we'll ask some questions of the speaker. So please, as questions occur to you, we don't have any questions in the can. The questions that we're going to ask are the questions that come from you. So feel absolutely free to send the user questions, your questions. So I'm super excited to have Marilyn tonight. I've been looking forward to this all week. I don't want to take up another minute of her time. I give you Marilyn.
Hi, I am Marilyn and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, David, for that generous and kind introduction. Really happy to be here, see some friends that I haven't seen for a while. And today has been a day packed with things. I just left a birthday party for a friend of mine, Nancy M., who probably some of you know, lived in Minnesota and is back in the Pacific Group, my home group in Los Angeles. And she was celebrating 50 years of sobriety. I've known her for a long time because this program has kept me sober now for 49 and a half years. So we grew up and grew old together. And before that, I was at a weekend retreat on the 12 steps, 12-step retreat given by Father Tom W. in Oakland. One of the things he talked about was this controversy in the fellowship. Are we recovering alcoholics or are we recovered alcoholics? And his answer was, yes, we are recovered to some extent. We're no longer drinking ourselves to death, but this journey never stops. I've just been so aware lately of my character defects bristling out all over, and I get irritated with the pandemic, and simultaneously I get irritated with people who don't wear masks at the proper time, and I think I should have outgrown all of these character defects. Well, I have come to believe that the seventh step just puts them in a closet for a while, and they can creep out at a moment's notice. But I didn't know anything about stuff like that. I just wandered through the life and was pretty miserable because of character defects. But I had something that I look back upon now as a higher power for me. It was actually a lesser power than the one we come to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. But for me, that was science. And I thought that science could give me a good life, all of these things that we want a higher power to give us, a community, support, friends, a sense of purpose, answers to big questions. And science goes a long way at providing that kind of thing, but nevertheless, it's a lesser power. And when we have these lesser powers like job or money or relationship, which gives guidance to our life, these lesser powers always lead to a lesser kind of life. But I, at that time, did not suspect that it would be lesser. I just thought that this would be the answer. And so it led me to the University of Chicago, where there were lots of scientists, and I studied science and went to get a job in a laboratory. And this very tall, pale fellow in a white lab coat walked out to give me a test to see if I could get that job in the lab. And I was nervous, and yet he was so kind. And the test involved a microscope. I had to scan some things in a microscope and point out what I saw. And he showed me how the microscope worked. And he had these long, slender fingers. And he, as he turned the knobs on a microscope, that just, oh, it looked so scientific. And I was getting all excited. But even more so, he had a slide rule in his pocket. And that's, for you younger folks, an old-fashioned calculator. I mean, that's how we used to multiply numbers. There's someone that's actually acting out one, Scott. And so I just saw that slide rule, and that was really science. And oh, I wanted to grab and fondle his slide rule. And I got that job, by the way. And we began to get acquainted. He sent me a postcard. He had gone to a meeting, and it was a picture of the Lincoln Memorial. And I turned it over, and it said, "Dear Marilyn, all I can come up with is," and he wrote out this elegant partial differential equation, and no man had ever talked to me like that before. I was falling in love, and sometimes I look back on that time and I think, did this really happen? Well, just the other day, I was looking at a little red velvet box, and I have that postcard from 1958. Happy memories. And so I got that job, as I said, and we seemed to speak the same language. We talked about Gegenbauer polynomials and stuff like that. And that seemed like a real relationship. And then one day he said, "Do you want to get married?" And I just screamed, "Yes, yes." And we went off to a little religious ceremony in Ohio because his dad was a Lutheran minister there. Now, Bill and I were both atheists. We worshiped science, and science had all the answer. And we had a lot of scorn for anyone who believed in a supernatural higher power. I mean, that just seemed absurd because it would kind of violate all the laws of physics and chemistry that we knew about. And science had answers to big things, so you don't really need God. And yet we were in this little religious ceremony, and Bill's dad was saying those magic words for better, for worse, for richer, poor, sickness and health. And Bill, being a man that listened to those words and tried to follow them, said, "I do." And I listened to those words, and to me, they spelled, "Now I can attach to you like a tick on a dog and drain out your life." And I proceeded to do just that. And so you can well imagine how things went, but that was love to me. Unhealthy, parasitic attachment. Grab your lapels and scream, "You don't love me. You don't love me enough, do you? That's why I'm so miserable." And we get into fierce arguments. We got into an argument about the nature of gravitational force one time, and Bill put me to shame. So I stopped talking to him for 2 or 3 years. And he got real happy after that, which made me really upset. It was during this time of silence that we acquired a cat. And so we could talk through this cat named Abelard. And Bill took a job in Los Angeles, and we drove across the country. And still, we weren't speaking. And we'd have to say, "Abelard, can you tell Bill to grind down his window? It's awfully hot in here." And it worked. So we got to California, and we were both trying to be scientists. Bill was a physicist and I was doing physiology, and we both had our labs. And that was when we entered the early 60s. And it was during that time that I came into contact with what became the new higher power. And this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, so you can guess what that is. But it just seemed to be everywhere. It was in our lab. It was at parties. At one early party I went to with Bill, it was actually his department. And he was new in the department, and I wanted to help him out. I wanted to help make a good impression so that it would help his career. And I saw the chairman of his department, and I went over to talk to the chairman. And it had been one of these parties. It was actually a Halloween party. And I'd worn a harlequin costume with little hat with little bells on it and bright orange pants. And we were all in costume. So I proceeded to talk to the chairman. And I wanted to impress him that I too was a scientist. And so I started talking about something about crustaceans, and he was kind of tuning out. So I kind of made my voice louder. And then I realized that in my excitement, I was wetting my pants and a puddle was forming on the floor. And I just thought, what am I going to do? I hate when this happens. And so the chairman just kind of backed away from the puddle, turned and walked out of the room. And I was standing there pretty much alone. And I spotted some French doors, and I walked through the doors into the backyard. And I thought, I've got to flee. I've got to run away from here. I can't go back in there. But there was a high cinder block wall, and I knew that I couldn't scale it. It looked like it was at least 6 feet high. And I just sat down, worrying, troubled. And then I noticed that there was a playpen and a dachshund in the playpen. And that dachshund looked miserable and was whining. And so I went over to comfort the dog. And so I reached in to pet this poor dachshund, and that thing snaps its jaws down on my hand. And I pulled my hand out, ripping the skin way back. And there I stood with a bloody hand. And I just didn't know what to do, but I thought, maybe I better go back in the house, which I did. And it was the luck of the alcoholics. It was this amazing gift from fortune that nobody noticed my wet pants. They just looked at this bloody hand dripping all over the floor. And I was taken off to emergency. And I mean, these were the fun days. And I was having such a great time, and just escaped terrible embarrassment by this wonderful dachshund. And so that was how life was going. I drank a lot in my lab too. We had lab alcohol there and we drank it. You're not supposed to drink it. You're supposed to use it for research, but it was good 90% ethanol. And so these were the fun days. Now, Bill was a normal person, did not drink, hated the effect that it had on him, made him sleepy and clumsy. And so he was working very hard to establish a career, but I was pursuing the guidance of my new higher power, alcohol. And there were a few people in the lab that was of a like mind. And we would go out after work. We called it work. Go to bars. And as I said, these were the great days. I was at a party with Bill. Actually, these were his colleagues. There were lots of parties in those days. And there were two friends, my friends, because the three of us drank a lot. We all drank a lot. And we'd all gravitate toward a corner at the party. And we would gradually sink down because we were leaning against the wall. And in a corner, there's two walls, as you know. But there were three of us. So that would leave one person standing. And that person would go get more drinks. And then eventually all three of us would be on the floor in a little tight circle. And then we'd pass out and somebody would take us home. And so we'd do that consistently at these parties where the two friends, Bob and Roy, would go. Now, what happened, just to look many, many years later, was that I crashed and burned and eventually ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was sober, we learned about Bob. Bob was still trying to do science, had a lab, but growing increasingly more depressed, but thought it was severe depression rather than alcoholism. And one day it was too much for him, and he killed himself in the physics shop. He had a gun and ended his life. And a few years later, I was speaking at my home group, little Ohio Street meeting place. And Roy walked up to the podium after I finished talking. And I hadn't seen him for years. He was my drinking buddy, one of the three. And I said, "Oh my gosh, is it Roy? I'm so happy to see you." And he said, "I'm glad you're happy, because I'm not." He had just gotten out of treatment and was a couple days sober and looked miserable, but he looked sober. And I was so happy to see him. And we stayed in contact until he moved away. And he was in his 20-something sobriety when he moved away, and I lost touch. But I hope that he's sober to this day. And that is really good. That was two out of three that found what I think is lasting sobriety. And that beats the odds, because alcoholics, most alcoholics don't find Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm grateful for that. But back in those days when I was departing my higher power science and moving to alcohol, what was happening was something that I didn't notice. This thing, alcohol, that brought so much fun into my life, that made it safe for me to be in a room with other people, made it safe for me to talk to other people, made me a happy person, now was complicating my life, and it was beginning to control my life, and it was beginning to take away those things in my life that I valued. It took away my career, because I really thought that I was doing a lot of work. As long as I drank, I felt like a real scientist. I felt like I'm going to win the Nobel Prize. But what was happening, though, I was doing more and more drinking and less work. And one day, my career was gone. The director noticed that I wasn't doing anything, just wasting equipment, wasting time, spending money. And it was time to go. And that was a sad day. So now, alcohol became a new kind of friend. It was a friend in utter despair. I was at home and lost my career, the one thing that I thought I needed for happiness. And somehow it just drifted away when I started drinking. I just sat on the couch for a while, and somehow, without planning, our house filled up with little children, and they were mine. There were only three of them, but it just seemed like a great flock of them. I was ill prepared to be a mother and continue to drink, because alcohol was the one thing that got me through the day after day. And I was losing the ability to take care of these children, to make meals, to do those things that civilized people do. But trying to hang on. By that time, some of the children were in preschool. And the first thing I noticed, bad thing that happened, was that I was invited to be in a carpool. And very shortly after I was invited to be in the carpool, I was told I was no longer welcome in the carpool. I forgot to pick up the children. Mothers worried about that. So I lost my place in the carpool. The next thing that happened was the director of the preschool, when I took a couple of little children in, said to me, "You seem to be a troubled mom. And we have a program for troubled moms. And it's given by the person who heads up this preschool. And he's a counselor. And he has little group sessions. They're free, but they're for the troubled moms of the children in the preschool. So I want you to go to one of those sessions." Well, I thought, okay, I will brace for that. I will go to one of those sessions. because having that kind of clingy, parasitic nature, I had formed an attachment to the director of the preschool and that teacher, and I wanted her approval desperately. That goes along with that kind of unhealthy attachment. I want you to like me. I'll attach to you, live for me, give my life meaning and make me feel like I'm worthwhile and love me. Please, please approve of me. And so I had that going for the teacher that greeted me. And she wanted me to go to that little group session. So I knew that in order to get her approval, I had to do it. So by that time, beer had become my favorite drink because I had stopped eating. You can drink beer and it has a lot of sugar in it and you can live on beer. It's a whole meal. And you don't have to drink water even. It's so full of water. It's food and water and alcohol. The three requirements for normal living and oxygen, of course. And you can get along on a diet of pure beer. And so a case a day just served me well. So I braced myself with a lot of beer and went off to that little group session. And it was not too painful because I had prepared. We left and I thought, good, I've done that. But the group leader said, all right, see you same time next week. And I thought, oh no, this is something we have to do more than once. And wanting his approval, I knew I was going to have to do it. Well, the second or third time I went back, the session ended and the leader of the group said, Mrs. Slater, I want you to stay after. Could you stay after for a while? And I just felt that cold hand grasp my heart. It's that feeling that I had now and then. They have begun to notice, and they're noticing something they don't approve of. They have begun to notice, and that's a scary feeling. But I stayed because I wanted his approval. And after everybody else had left the room, he said to me, I'd like to ask you, have you ever considered going to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I just thought, why is he asking me a question like that? So I said to him, why are you asking me a question like that? And he said, well, you come in smelling like alcohol to these group sessions and you're really wobbly. And tonight you were sitting and you were listing so in your chair that you fell on the floor. And I had no defense because I had no memory of that happening. It was kind of like busted. I tried to make some feeble excuses, like I have these children and I have to stay home and be a good mom. And I think this organization requires you to go to meetings probably in the evenings. And he said, I'll tell you something. You're concerned about your family, and the best gift you can give to your family is to get your head screwed on right. And I thought, man, this is cold. This is horrible. Well, I never went back to that group again, as you can well imagine. And I certainly didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous then. But things began to get bad. And everyone who knew me was telling me the same thing. You've got to stop drinking. You are a danger to the children. You're ruining your life and you're ruining the life of others. You've got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that thing that he had said to me made a difference. It was a gift to my family. Maybe I should do this. So in 1969, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. And I was going really for these people that kept saying, you've got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't going for myself because secretly I knew I'm not an alcoholic. I knew that I had terrible psychic pain. I'd lost my career. I felt worthless. Everybody else was better than I was. I'm a fraud. No wonder I have to drink, but that doesn't mean I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics are different. They drink because they love alcohol and they like to drink, and that's it. They stop drinking and then they're happy people. And I knew when I stopped drinking, I was unhappy. That was not a solution for me. But while I was going to those meetings, and I went to meetings for about 3 months, I didn't drink because of peer pressure. I wanted the approval of people. And they would say things like, "We stay sober one day at a time." Well, that made sense. I could do that. We stay sober one day at a time. And we go to lots of meetings. And I went to lots of meetings then. And we don't drink between meetings. And somehow, just those simple things, this group is called Simple Actions. Those simple actions, even though I didn't understand what was going on in the program, I didn't get a sponsor, I didn't even read the steps, I was staying sober by some power in this program. And simple actions, going to lots of meetings, not drinking one day at a time, not drinking between meetings. And somehow I was given that power through this program not to drink. But it was not making me happy. I was getting ever more miserable. And while I was there, I noticed some people. One was a larger than life figure. That was a guy named Clancy. And he had founded the group that I was always taken to, the Pacific group. And I had never met larger than life figures except in science, like Nobel Prize winners. Every now and then they'd come to UCLA and give a lecture. And I was in awe of them. Well, I was kind of in awe of this person, Clancy, because he had some kind of charisma. And it was clear that he was holding a great big group together and causing a lot of fun and enthusiasm and whipping people into shape to take a lot of wild and crazy actions that seemed to be a lot of fun for them. And I didn't feel that I was a part of that. I was very much apart from it, but I was observing it. And there was another person I observed from afar, and that was Marion, the wonderful Marion W. And she was not a female Clancy, but a radiant figure. And people seemed to love her. She had a kind of wisdom and had the respect of others. And I wanted to go up and talk to her, but I didn't, because she just seemed unapproachable. And I wanted her to come over and talk to me, which she did not do. So we never got acquainted. And after about 3 months, I knew it was safe to leave this fellowship. Just to be safe, I wouldn't drink. And I went home. And as you can well imagine, having three little children, they began to make me really anxious and a little bit irritated. And they demanded many things like food and wanted me to play with them, get down on the floor and play with them. And if I had enough to drink, I could do things like that. But then I would pass out and Bill would come home and find me pass out. And I tried to taper on, but you know how that works once you leave Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I was drinking way too much and Bill was frantic and he imported his mother, my mother-in-law. And I kind of moved to the garage to get away from her. And that was okay with her, it seemed. She took care of the family and I loathed and hated her for replacing me. But every now and then she would give me encouragement, as I would say. Unless you get control of your life and stop drinking, we're going to lock you up and you'll never see the children again. I just thought, boy, how dare you talk to me like that? I mean, this is my garage. How can you do that? But she meant business. And not long after these lectures, I called Central Office and they sent a 12-step worker. And this was different. I don't think I would have gone back had not she come to my house. And she told me her story and said she was going to take me to a meeting. And I said, "Lorena, I'm a scientist, so I need a dark, quiet meeting." And she said, well, she knew some dark, quiet meetings. And I also said, "And do you know Marion? I want to meet the person named Marion." Well, she didn't know who I was talking about, but just said that we'd run into each other if we both stayed sober. So I wanted Lorena's approval, and she said, "We've got to go to a meeting tonight." She stayed with me all that afternoon. And I didn't drink because she was there in the house. And of course, I had attached to her, wanting her approval. I had to refrain from drinking. My head hurt, but off we went to a dark, quiet meeting. And it was kind of a jolting experience. There were speakers at the first part of the meeting. I don't know what they said. I think I dozed off a little bit. I couldn't remember having a fierce headache. And then something even more jolting was what they called coffee break. And people got up rattling chairs and I stayed in my seat. People seemed to settle down again. And then the leader got up to the podium and said, "Tonight our main speaker is Marion W." And I looked up and there was my Marion. Now, how can that happen? I don't know. To this day, I have no idea how that happened. My scientist friends said, "Well, it's a coincidence. Things like that happen." And there are things that happen by coincidence that are way, way out on standard curves. Like it could be out maybe 7 or 8 standard deviations out on a normal distribution. You know, they talk like that. But I just couldn't believe it. I just thought there is something going on here that I don't understand. And this was a very different experience from my first trip in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had seen the mystery. I had seen the power. I mean, this thing of having Marion show up really changed my whole outlook on Alcoholics Anonymous. And it stayed with me, this awe of the fellowship, the mystery here. I don't understand how it works, but we don't have to understand. We just have to do it. We have to read how it works, which gets us into a program of action. But what I'm really saying is that there is a great power in this fellowship that's so beyond human understanding that in this lifetime, I don't think we can ever solve that puzzle. But it's very important to seek it and cooperate with it. And that was the beginning for me. Of course, after the meeting, I ran up and attached to Marion, tick-like, and said, "Would you be my sponsor? Would you be my sponsor?" And she agreed to do that if I would come to her home group, the Pacific group. So once more, I was back in the Pacific group. Somehow, I look back on that time, my period of atheism, and realize that my higher power was working so on my behalf. Working overtime, it seemed, to get Marion to that meeting somehow mysteriously, and to get me into the Pacific group, no matter how much I resisted it, because I needed custodial care. I needed a strong group with a lot of structure, a lot of people to whom I was accountable. And that big active group was one of those things. What was beginning to happen was that I brought all my character defects along with me. And that one big one that I keep talking about was unhealthy dependency. But along with that was giant need for approval. Now, I did not understand the program, but because I had a desperate need for Marion to approve of me, I did all of the things she suggested, which were a lot. I had to get a babysitter to come in at night because mother-in-law had gone home knowing that I was sober. And I said, "I don't know how to do that." And I was told I had to go to a meeting every night. And I had those little children, and Bill needed to go back to his lab at night. And so he couldn't stay home and take care of them. So Marion said, "That is not a problem." And she told me exactly how to hire a high school student to come every evening, do homework, and be a babysitter. And we could afford that babysitter. And that allowed me to go to a meeting every night. Marion began to solve these practical problems for me. I didn't know how to take care of these little children. And she would say things like, "Okay, Marilyn, you've come out of a coma, out of a lot of darkness, and we're going to start easy. And you're going to be a mom. So today you're going to count. You're just going to count them and see what we're dealing with." And I had kind of lost count, but then I counted them. 1, 2, 3. Only 3. She said, "That's manageable." And she began to just teach me these simple things, how to care for children, how to make a meal for Bill, how to do these things in my selfish and self-centered nature. I never did. I never learned. And that was the wonderful Marion coaching me on that stuff. She also coached me on Alcoholics Anonymous and introduced me to these steps. And of course, they mentioned the word God, and I had kind of bristled at that word being an atheist scientist. And she had me read a book called Your God is Too Small. I was willing to believe in the mystery, in some power here. And when we'd get up to say the Lord's Prayer or the Serenity Prayer, I would just say something like, to myself, of course, great force in the universe that somehow made it possible that Marion was the speaker at that first meeting that I was brought back to you to. And then I could say amen with everybody else. And one day I was talking with a friend who was actually 40 years sober at that time, the wonderful John L. And a deeply kind spiritual man. And he was kind of a mentor. And I was telling him my little secret. And he said, John, I'm really an atheist at heart. I do believe that Alcoholics Anonymous works, but this prayer business is such a mystery for me, how to handle that. So I came up with a plan. And I told him what I did, how I just bow my head and I say to myself, along with everybody else, force in the universe that brought Marion to that meeting that I was brought back to. And then I say amen with everybody. And he looked at me and was smiling. And I said, so I just fool everybody. And they think that I'm praying to God, but I'm really saying that prayer because I can believe in that. And John said, oh, Marilyn, I hate to break this to you, but that's what we're all doing. We're just praying to something we can believe in, something we can understand. Some people are praying to the Pacific Ocean. Some guy prays to his doorknob, I hear. Whatever we can believe in that should be some power outside of ourselves. And made me think, maybe I had a misunderstanding here. So I didn't worry about that too much anymore, but I did take the steps and I got into action. Somehow the steps have a civilizing effect, especially, all of them, of course, all of these 9 steps turn us into civilized human beings. They get us to clean up the past that's so dreadful. Mine was, I was so embarrassed by the people I had stolen from, the opportunities I'd squandered, the people that I was so abusive to in my own family, to my children that I had neglected, and I had to make living amends forever. God has granted me a long life because I have a lot of long living amends to make. It also, the steps civilize us, and because they civilized me, because I made amends to the director of that lab where I drank so much, after a few years of making amends that just didn't quite feel right, they were basically an apology, I tried to make amends, tried to give back in some kind of way. He called and he offered me a job, and so I went back to work at the scene of the crime. And from there, I went back to school and finished degrees that were unfinished. I'm not really very good in the lab, even in sobriety. So I went into another career, medical informatics and handling scientific information with computers that were just turning into wonderful machines during these years. And that's been great fun. And in these later years, I've taught science and teach at a lifelong learning institute and teach the science courses. And that was given to me just by taking these steps. And somewhere along the way, the veil parted and I came into contact with a God of my very own. And when that happened to me, it was a great surprise because it was coming from a position of such disbelief. And as the veil parted, I realized it was just as a result of the steps which had caused a lot of these character defects, basic selfishness, and thinking about myself all the time, thinking about the guilt I felt, thinking about these terrible resentments, just clearing away a lot of that debris so that some kind of light could come in, and it parted a veil. And it was, oh, you've been there all along. I see it now. I saw it in experience after experience that all made sense to me, coincidence after coincidence. Experience. I saw it in the recovery of others. I saw it in my own recovery. You've been there all along, haven't you? The impossible, given alcoholics. We're so self-destructing. And we begin to seek this higher power. And we no longer try to kill ourselves. And it was obvious, the moment it was obvious, but not a minute before. I couldn't see until I could see. I couldn't hear until I could hear. And I went screaming out, trying to tell old timers, and they just, ah, yes, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Good, good, good. I mean, they weren't impressed. I was impressed because I was an atheist. I thought, well, I'll tell newcomers, they'll be impressed. Well, they just looked at me like I was weird and wandered away to talk to saner people. I even talked to the great Chuck C. And I tried to talk to him about my spiritual experience. I've come into contact with a God of my very own. And he looked at me and he laughed. He said, that's good. That's good. But don't make a big deal of it. Just do what's right in front of you. Go to lots of meetings. Work with newcomers. Tell them about it. So I thought that this was world shattering, that had changed my sobriety forever. Well, it did. Now I knew that there was a God that I could trust. But throughout the many years, which have been 40 some that followed, I have had one epiphany after another. And so my idea of a higher power keeps changing, but not without going away for a while. I lose faith. The first time I lost faith was that I was sponsoring a person whom I loved very much, and sponsorship has been a large part of my program, a great gift of this fellowship, and I'm glad that I grew up in a group that emphasizes strong sponsorship. And anyway, she was doing a job. She was a social worker, but she felt that it was not her calling. She loved art history, and because of taking the steps, being sober for a while, and she went back to school and studied art history. And it was made easy for her. And we would say, this, see how God is working in your life. And it was beautiful to watch her recovery and watch her have that courage to go to school and study art history. And then she worked on a PhD and wanted an academic career, and you get a PhD for an academic career. And it seemed to fall into place beautifully. She got a graduate advisor. Wrote a wonderful dissertation. I went to her graduation from Tufts and watched her walk with the cap and gown. And we just said, see how God is working in your life. It is so beautiful. And it caused me such joy and increased my passion for my higher power, God working in her life. And then she did a postdoc. She got a postdoc right away, God working in her life. And then as she was well into her postdoc, she was offered an academic position in a university, a tenure track position, the thing that all academics long for, a tenure track position. And God is good. It's so wonderful. And we celebrated. And then she called one day, and she lived on the East Coast, but we were very close and talked pretty much every day. And I loved her. And she called one day and she said she had a terrible pain. And so we talked about that, and you better get it checked out. And she got it checked out. And the doctor was a little bit worried and had ordered some scans. And they saw a mass. And that's not what you want to hear from your doctor. And she had exploratory surgery, and it turned out to be widespread pancreatic cancer. And I couldn't say, see how God is working in your life. And I lost my faith. I lost it. And I tried to support Sally, my beloved sponsee. And I must tell you that she handled this so much better than I did. Her faith grew. And I tried to hide my lack of faith. And I was glad that she was living thousands of miles away at that time because she was surrounded by her AA community that I am sad to say was able to give her more support than I could. And so she left this life. And the thing, and I kept seeking, I kept trying to talk to, are you there? How could this happen? It just seemed that things were going so well, and how could life be so cruel if you are a loving God? And my daughter had the answer, and she's not even an alcoholic, but she had a conversion experience of her own and has a deep faith in God and found, actually she joined the church and finds God in that way. And we talked, and she said, remember when we were small, Dad used to read Winnie the Pooh to us. And there was one story where Winnie the Pooh and Piglet were walking together, and Piglet says, what is your favorite thing? And Winnie the Pooh said, eating honey. And then he thought for a moment, and he said, no, it's that moment before eating honey. And it's the anticipation. And Susie pointed out, now Susie is a real scientist and she has an academic career. And she went through that whole thing of getting a PhD, doing a postdoc, getting an offer at a university. Now she's a professor in a university. And she said that she had that moment before eating honey when she was offered a position in a university. And then she took the job. And then there were academic committee meetings, and there were students complaining about their grades, and there were competitive professors, and there was grants that did not come through, and there were funds running out in the laboratory, and explosions in the lab. It's a hard life, and it requires a lot of patience. So eating the honey wasn't as much fun as that moment before. The anticipation. And she just pointed out that Sally had that. And if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, your life is full of opportunities and joy and challenges. But Sally went out on a high note that moment before eating honey. And in that, my faith was restored. I just saw a more complicated journey, but an interesting one. And that has served me well because I now have given up the whole idea of understanding how it works. I no longer say, see how God is working for you, because God is always working for us. The program is always working for us. And I have become much simpler. Okay, let me have a cup of coffee in the morning. Let me do some readings. Let me just see what seems to be in front of me today. Let me just have the strength to meet the daily challenges. I don't think too much beyond. And at night, I'm pretty grateful for that. I have stayed active. And one of those things is what we all do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We all get up and we visit one another's meetings and we tell our stories to one another. And somehow that allows us to identify eventually, instead of comparing with other people, we identify and we learn something that causes us to want to do those things, mostly the steps and full participation in the fellowship that heal us. And when I was 40 years sober, I was talking in Las Vegas at State Line Convention, and life was going so well that one of the character defects that had come out of the character defects closet was pride. And it was pride in the good life. And I realized that I'm married, I've been married for many, many years to the same man. We have a sweet relationship now. I fell in love with my Bill. Our children grew up and they were all having successful, happy lives. And our daughters produced a whole bunch of grandchildren that are adorable. And they've, everything is so good. And what I mean about pride was, I tended to think that if your life is not picture perfect, you're not doing it right. And now it's embarrassing to say that, but that's what pride is, that I was proud of my good program that has led me to this good life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a lot of sponsees and I have a home group and I have a wonderful family and I have a career and my husband has a career and we have nice cats and it's all good. And if you have less than that, well, maybe there's just something wrong with your program. Well, I was talking and I was trying to be humble and talking about the second step. And somehow I said, I find that I have a higher power, and in extremis, God meets me 90% of the way, maybe 99% of the way. And God carries us in hard times. Now, I don't know why I said that, because my life had been pretty good. But to give encouragement to those of whose lives were not so good. Well, when I got down from the podium, there was a lot of chatter on my phone, and I looked at it, and all family members were saying, we can't find David, our son. And he was all grown up and had a wonderful life, an elite athlete, a wonderful career, had married a beautiful woman who was a science teacher. He was a scientist with a career in science. All good, but they couldn't find him. And hours were going by and they were beginning to suspect maybe he's ill somewhere or had an accident. And so around 11 o'clock, we got word that police had entered his office and found that he had hanged himself in his office. Now, the bottom of my world dropped out. And I was in danger of going under for once and for all. Luckily, my sponsor at that time, Clancy had been my sponsor for many, many years. And luckily, he was at State Line. And so I called him close to midnight and woke him up in his room. And he was a little bit grumpy. If you know Clancy, you know he could be grumpy. But then I got out what I was calling him about. And Clancy was like Superman. Clark Kent with suit on. And then he'd go in a phone booth and he'd rip off the suit and there would be this big costume with a big S on the front. And then he'd take off and fly. And did Superman fly? Yes, I think faster than a speeding bullet. That was Clancy. When I told him that, he entered the phone booth and came out super sponsor. And when he was in that role of super sponsor, that was a hypnotic suggestion for me. He said, I know it's late, but you've got to go home. And you've got to get home in any way you can because your husband is all alone and he does not have a program. And this will kill him if you don't go. You have 40 years of sobriety to be a support. And that is your role now for the rest of your family. And of course I did that. That was the hypnotic suggestion. I do what my sponsor says when my life is pure chaos. And I started driving home. And God did meet me 90% of the way. I had a CD in the car to listen to, and it was the great Sandy Beach, who left us a few years ago. And he had lost his two daughters the year before. One was murdered in her front yard and the other died of our disease. And I knew Sandy, he was a friend of mine. And I knew that he had weathered that storm and there was joy in his life after a year. What an example. And I listened to that CD and he talked about the tragedy in his life. And he said that when that kind of thing happens, and I hope it doesn't happen to you, you have time to react. And in that moment, you go out to your higher power and you say, don't leave me. I'll not leave you. and you form that bond tighter than ever. And then he said, when you do begin to react in a big way, guess who comes back with you? And I could tell you that that is true. I practiced that on the drive for about 3 hours across the desert from Las Vegas to Los Angeles. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, I realized that my longtime friend on the program, Diana, we'd gotten sober together. We'd been friends forever. She knew David when he was a little boy. She knew the story of David. I knew I could call her because it was 6 a.m. in New York, 3 o'clock, Los Angeles time. And I told her what was happening, and it took her for a while to grasp this thing that seemed so improbable, so unlikely. And she said, I'm just going to talk to you. And she talked me all the way back into Los Angeles, my friend Diana. And there, somehow, very soon after, the whole fellowship in Los Angeles seemed to know what had happened. And they were there to offer the kind of support that got me through that time. I don't know how that happens, but our magazine, The Grapevine, is well named because we are a grapevine. Word spreads so rapidly. It's like we're a macro organism that just comes to the rescue of anybody who is down and in trouble. I talked with people who had experienced a similar tragedy besides Sandy. One was Diana's sponsee, Julie, who had lost her son 10 years before, and I went through that with her, and I knew she was fine. She had become secretary of our Wednesday night meeting and had a lot of joy in her life. And she kept saying, Marilyn, accept reality, accept, and then you will find that there is much joy beyond that. And I can tell you that is true. 10 years have passed, and there is great joy in my life. I sponsor more women than ever. And lots of newcomers have come into the program in this pandemic. And we have in our home group, the Pacific group, 3 meetings a day and all on Zoom. So you just can never be without a meeting. And in this last year, we lost Clancy. Clancy had been my sponsor for 30 years. And he was 60 years sober plus. And that was a long run. I thought that I would never find another sponsor, but I do have another sponsor, and that is Tom W. in Oakland, whose retreats I've been to for years and years and years, and that seems to be a sponsor that's just right for me right now. Out of tragedy, God always finds a replacement, finds some joy to replace the terrible, terrible void. We've lost our son, but I have 3 grown adult grandsons, one graduating from high school, and a granddaughter filling the void. Life is good, and that's my story. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. That was amazing. I'm going to allow everyone to unmute and say thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn.
Thank you, Marilyn. That was awesome.
Thank you so much, Marilyn.
Thank you, Marilyn.
Thank you, Marilyn.
Thank you, ma'am. That was fantastic. Thank you, ma'am.
Yes, it was.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to hear your words.
Blessings, Marilyn. Thank you so much. Bless me tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Marilyn. Great job.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to take the meeting back again, and we'll give Marilyn a break, and we'll do a little business here. So let's see. I always have to reorient. I'm completely spellbound at this point. Let's see. I'll put some links in the chat regarding the seventh tradition. Oh, and I always forget, please send your questions to the user questions. We're gonna reconvene here in about 5 minutes, and we'll get to ask Marilyn some questions. So please send your questions to the user questions. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential. At every level of AA service, it is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare. A word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Anybody? Where's my ebony? All right. I got a couple. This Wednesday, District 14 is doing a concepts workshop. We do a concept a month throughout 2021. So we'll be doing the fifth concept. We have past delegate Scott is going to lead that. He'll talk for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have a Q&A on the fifth concept. This home group, the Simple Actions Group, on June 2nd is having a workshop called The Family Afterward. We've got Polly P. and her son, James L. And that's a mother and son duo, and they'll do a presentation on June 2nd. That's at 7 p.m. That's on the simpleactions.net website, as well as tidewaterintergroup.org. And mark your calendars for June 12th, Saturday, the Saturday of service. That's from 1 to 4 p.m. District 14 Norfolk is the host of that event. Our delegate, Sherry, will come and give a report on what happened at the General Service Conference in April, as well as the other service entities in Tidewater. We'll talk briefly. So if you're interested in service or think you might be considering looking into being interested in service, that's a great day. Saturday of service, June 12th. And that's it for me, I think. Last call for announcements. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hand. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right, I'm hoping to switch my screen and find some questions. I see two. Come on, guys. Marilyn, my heart. Thank you so much for coming tonight. The first question we have is, you had mentioned some books that helped you early on in recovery. Are there any other books that help you today?
Yeah, I must say I'm kind of a bookaholic. I buy more books than I can ever read. And I just buy all kinds of books. If it says Alcoholics Anonymous or addictive personalities or spirituality or God, I want to buy it. And right now I have four boxes packed up to go off to a charity because I have to recycle these books as I don't have enough room on a bookshelf. Right now I'm currently reading, I always read the big book. I read the 12 and 12. I spend during the pandemic, when we don't go out into the world very much, I often spend 1 or 2 hours in the morning with the 11th step, do a lot of reading, do time for meditation and prayer. And currently reading some esoteric stuff. And I think it's because I changed sponsors, who happens to be a Jesuit. There's a lot of Ignatian spirituality. Now, I'm not recommending this, but I'm just telling you what I'm reading. And I find that absolutely fascinating. And there's one book, Ignatian Spirituality and the 12 Steps, written by a person named Jim Harbaugh. And it shows the great similarity between the 12 Steps and Ignatian Spirituality. And there's a book called, let's see, it's got sponsorship in the title. It's one of our publications from the New York office, The Soul of Sponsorship, I believe is the name of it. And it's the letters between Father Ed Dowling and Bill Wilson. And Father Ed Dowling was an overeater, so he had an addictive personality, but not an alcoholic. And Bill was a depressive, besides being an alcoholic. And they show their humanity in these letters. It's very beautiful. And Father Ed Dowling was struck with how similar the spiritual exercises of Ignatius are to the 12 steps. And although the 12 steps were not derived from these exercises, they actually came from the Oxford group, basically. But what it points to is that the all spiritual paths which have endured are pretty much saying the same thing. And there is another book that I'm reading called The Quest for the Living God. And the fine message in that book is that it's a mutual quest, that God looks for us just as hard as we look for God once we come to the program and begin to seek God. And it brings in a lot of these spiritual paths. And I am just struck with how similar they all are, how they're all saying the same message, which is, you're lucky if your life is shattered and broken and you need an answer. It's wonderful if you're desperate. And if you are, then you may turn to one of these spiritual paths. And these great spiritual paths tell you to surrender and look for something higher outside of yourself, and then clean up your mess and make it right. And then keep doing that. And then tell others about it and do that forever. And, you know, it's this common thread that runs through all of them. I've never gone to Al-Anon. I mean, I've been in Al-Anon meetings, especially at conventions. You know, they always have the Al-Anon luncheon speaker. I like Al-Anon because I can send my sponsees to Al-Anon when they are hung up on somebody else and wanting to change somebody else. I say, unless you stop talking about him, you have to go to Al-Anon. And it works, because either they stop talking about him or they go to Al-Anon, which eventually works, and they stop talking about him. So I'm a believer. So I read this book every morning, Courage to Change. And it has a one day of reading. And I read daily reflections. I like that. I like the things that begin and end on a page and have the date. I like the poet Mary Oliver, and I read a poem of Mary Oliver every day. And she finds God in simple things. And I'm not very visual, and I overlook so many things. And she's a reminder for me to just stop and look, walk out into my backyard and see that there's some flowers out there, to see that there are little birds and things, and all of those begin to sing to me, and I have to be reminded of that. And I find Mary Oliver is a good reminder. So that's some of the things I'm reading right now.
Oh, thank you. How has COVID changed how you work with others, if at all?
It's caused me to be more intense in my program, just because there's hardly anything else to do except Alcoholics Anonymous. The place where I teach, I just found that it's not really effective to do remote learning and teaching. So I took a leave of absence and go to lots of meetings and work with these newcomers that are coming into the fellowship. And it's certainly caused me to have more time for my 11th step. As I said, you know, since there's so little to do, you know, you don't get up and get dressed in a hurry and run out into the world and do stuff these days. I have a couple of hours to spend with prayer and meditation. And that has certainly improved my outlook on life tremendously. And I don't know why it does that, but I think the obvious thing is it just gets my mind off of myself and onto something higher and reminds me constantly to listen to others. I have a lot of time for phone calls because I'm at home a lot more than I was during the regular life, and have more sponsees than I had before the pandemic, and talk to them a lot. So more intensity. We have these two new meetings a day in the Pacific group. There's Zoom meetings, one at 6:30 in the morning, the other is at 1 o'clock, and I'm secretary of one of the 1 o'clock ones. And that's been great fun host that meeting. We have about over 200 people that come to the 1 o'clock meeting every Monday from all over the world. And I think that that's been a great benefit of the pandemic, is that it's been a great tragedy for the world. But on the other hand, it's made us understand that Alcoholics Anonymous is an international phenomenon. And now we have friends all over the place. I sponsor women outside the country and get to see them at meetings now. So all of that's been very, very good. The sad I have to mention, though, there is sadness. We've lost at least 4 members of our group to COVID. And so that was an unexpected and horrible tragedy. And we remember them and we're sad about that. But as Alcoholics Anonymous always teaches, we accept that. And we know that they have gone to a blessed place. And then we begin to look for the blessings that follow, the blessings in our life. Okay, done.
Thank you. Have you had the experience of meeting someone virtually and taking them through the 12 steps?
Meeting them virtually.
Or a newcomer in the past year or so?
Let's see. I've gotten new people, but not... unfortunately, I haven't gotten absolute new ones, you know, where they don't know anything. I have many grand sponsees that are new. And the ones that I got during the pandemic who are not new are about 2 years sober. And so they are still writing inventories and we're doing steps together. And they're sponsoring some people who have come in the pandemic who are new, and I've gotten to know them. We have a meeting every Tuesday night, which we call the lineage meeting. And it's the women I sponsor, well, now women and men that I sponsor, and the people on down the line, so that there are grand sponsees and great grand sponsees and so forth. And we all get to know one another. So I know my grand sponsees and cheer them on. It's kind of like being a grandmother because I get to watch their progress and my sponsees are doing the hard work of getting them civilized and accustomed to going to lots of meetings and taking the steps, and they get out of that argumentative stage and grandma just gets to love them and just say, "You're doing so well." And then they like me.
Typical grandma. I love this question. I've heard the name Clancy in a lot of meetings. I'm new to AA. Who is he?
Ah, yes. Who is Clancy? You know, people will ask that question in years to come. And in these last years, when Clancy was getting up in years, when we were all getting up in years, but Clancy was a little bit ahead of us, we used to say, you know, people in the future will say, "Who is the, was this Clancy? What was it like to know him? He's a legend. Was a legend in his own time, and now he is a legend." And I think we just decided we're lucky to have lived and been a part of this group that he founded, and we knew Clancy up close and personal, And it's very difficult to say what that experience was like. But he was probably as helpful as anybody else in the fellowship in carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a great communicator and was able to talk about alcoholism in a way that allowed people who had grave doubts that they were alcoholics to listen to his one talk, and suddenly a light bulb went on and they knew they were alcoholics. Now, he seemed to say what other people said, and he had a very good way of communicating, but somehow with Clancy, it got across. And it saved lives, because these people would not have been able to come to the fellowship unless they had admitted to their innermost selves that they were alcoholics. That's the one and only requirement that we have. And the gift that they received from him was the one and only requirement to be a part of this fellowship that saved their lives and allowed them lasting sobriety. So that was the great, great thing about Clancy, his communication skills. But the other thing was, and he, because of his own enthusiasm and hard work, built a group that's probably the largest ongoing group in existence, the Pacific Group. And he did that by pouring out his own life into that group. He just gave so much of himself. And he did it in so many ways. In the time, the many years that I knew Clancy and knew him up close as a sponsor, I saw him go out and give talks. Anybody that asked him to talk, he would say yes and would do that. And when he was home on the weekends, he was there in the backyard pitching in the baseball games, doing that yard, that Saturday yard. All alcoholics were invited to the yard, and the women would play volleyball, and the men would go across the street and play softball. And then the guys would come over and we'd eat lunch together, and then we'd all play volleyball, mixed groups. Oh, gosh. You'd go home and then come back to the Saturday night meeting. Clancy was always there if he was in town, not out of town speaking. After the meeting, he'd stay, and there was a rickety old piano at the Second in Arizona building where we met. And he'd sit down and play old barroom songs, and he could play by ear. He was a wonderful musician. And there was a guy in the group named Chick, and Chick would sing "That Rainy Day Is Here Again." And "I'll Be Loving You Always," and old World War II songs. And oh my gosh, we'd sing, and we'd have time to get to a place where we'd hold a watch and somebody would be turning one, and we'd stay there after midnight, and Clancy would be there. And then the next day he'd be on the move. We'd meet at Clancy's house and we'd go out and move somebody's furniture. And then he'd be at an activity in the afternoon because of Clancy's. I think he invented the watches, watch people when they turn one, make sure they don't take a drink before midnight. And then he also, I think, invented the group moves. It was like a fireman's brigade, and we'd all go out and move somebody's furniture. Even if they didn't want to move, we'd have to move them because we wanted to stay sober. And the neighbors would see about 50 or to 100 people come in to move somebody's truckload of furniture. And we'd all eat lunch together and then go home, go to a meeting that night. Clancy was ever present in all of these activities. Now, New Year's, these shows would come up. He wrote the New Year's play year after year with songs. They would be songs that were on Broadway, but he'd write different words to them, like "To Oklahoma." And they would be all about sobriety. And we'd have a New Year's show with the Pacific Group players. I found an old program from year one of my sobriety, and I was the set decorator. And of course, Clancy was the director. He had written the show and was the director of the show. It was in the show. And then I thought, this is going to be sad because I won't know any of these names because I've forgotten them all. And I looked down at the program. I knew every name on the program. And there were lots of people in the program, the people that were behind the scenes like me, the people that provided food and refreshments, I knew all of them because all of them stayed sober in the Pacific group or moved out of town and started sister groups all over the place, like Central Pacific group and the California group and Atlantic group. I knew that many of them had passed on sober, and many of them were still in the Pacific group. I was just astounded. So somehow this magic in the, I just have to digress. There were complaints about the Pacific group because everybody envies a successful group. Everybody envied Clancy, so then they tried to put him down, of course. But the thing that that was so interesting is that everybody was happy and having a good time. And these people on the outside were kind of miserable and going to quiet meetings and were criticizing all the happy people together and saying they're not doing it right. And one of the complaints is they don't distinguish activities from actions. And it's actions that are important. The actions are these steps that we take and the traditions that we follow. These are the actions. That's what counts. And you mix up activities and actions. Well, moves, group moves, and yard, and baseball, and plays. Well, I'll tell you, there is just something to be said for these activities because they civilized me. I didn't know how to play together. And by being forced to work with people in groups, that was very civilizing. It was embarrassing. It hurt my feelings when I cut into lines and they'd say, we don't cut into lines, you know, when I wouldn't show up for a commitment. We show up early for our commitments. Actions, activities. Activities are the fellowship, and it's all important. And I don't know what keeps us sober, but I do know that actions plus activities certainly added a lot to my sobriety. So Clancy gave all of these things by giving himself, by full participation. He didn't say, do this. This is what I did when I was new. He just kept doing it again and again, over and over. Yep, he loved it. And he always said it was a selfish thing because he was so intense and so crazy that he had to do that much just to stay sober. And we are all the beneficiaries of it.
Such a presence. I had the joy of being out at State Line in Las Vegas with my sponsor and one of my sponsees, and we were at the table. And then Clancy comes by the table and gives my sponsee a hard time about something, a good-natured hard time about something. And off he went, and my sponsee was so proud to have been given a hard time.
Yes, so he singled out.
Oh, my.
Yep, that's the initiation by fire when Clancy tears you apart in front of everybody. Congratulations, you're a part of now. You're a part of the group.
Yeah. You know, you talked about something. I don't know if there's more in there. Feel free to pass on this, but I love the Ignatian 12 steps angle and talking about Father Dowling. And one of the only things that I remember from the book, Pass It On, was here's Bill sitting in his room and he's all depressed and feeling sorry for himself. And he meets Father Dowling and he says, Father, is there no end to this? Is there no end to this agita and angst and dissatisfaction? And Father Dowling took Bill Wilson's head off like, no, there is no end to this. And he called it, and straighten me out if I'm wrong, but he referred to it as something like divine dissatisfaction, that it is this anxiety that propels you forward to do God's work.
Yeah, that's the great people in Alcoholics Anonymous, Father Ed Dowling, eventually Bill Wilson, of course, and the great Chuck Chamberlain talked about that a lot. There's eustress as opposed to distress. You know, life is stressful, and we can come to regard it as eustress. It stretches us. It makes us grow. Chuck Chamberlain talked about the burr under the saddle. that he had after his initial surrender to the program, 3 years in heaven. And then the old sausage grinder started again, he said. You know, you get out into the world, you resume your career, and you meet up with life, and there's stress, the burr under the saddle. And it is, I think, I don't know what it's all about. As I say, I just drink my coffee and try to think about the day and what's in front of me. But in those moments when I think there's got to be more to this life, I do believe, as Bill says, we'll be fine in the here and the hereafter. I believe we go on to something grander than this. I can't imagine what it would be, but I believe that there is something there. So I have to see this life as a series of spiritual lessons that prepare us for this next step. And I think, as Chuck Chamberlain said, infinite father, infinite child, there will always be as much ahead of us as there is right now, because that's what infinite means. And we just keep growing forever. We leave this life, but I think we still evolve after this life. And so this is a part of it. These spiritual lessons we learn, and some of them have been really, really hard. The loss of family members, the loss of my beloved sponsee, the loss of Clancy, the loss of my husband, which is hard to talk about, but I lost him a little more than a year ago. And yet these are lessons that we go on and we look for the blessings in life, the joy, and we share that with others. Constant spiritual lessons, looking for God behind the curtains.
We are out of time. You've been so generous with yours. I'm going to just, if you don't mind, I'm going to press you for one more. How do you prevent your, or how do you avoid drifting into morbid reflection?
I think that my sponsees save me from that. No matter what morbid reflection I'm in, they can call, and they're so irritating sometimes that I just have to start thinking about them. And how can you get out of this terrible resentment that you have? Do you want to be miserable? And I find that I'm telling them the answer that I need myself, of course. But, you know, we talk to one another. We're a talking fellowship. We're not contemplatives. We're whatever the opposite of that is. And so I am always dragged out, but I have to be dragged out though. And morning readings get me to another place, and then contact with other alcoholics are the greatest for that kind of thing.
Oh, thank you so much. Just wonderful, Marilyn. What a joy to meet you and spend time with you. Everybody will get an opportunity to thank her again after the Lord's Prayer. And let's see, Leanne, could I ask you to read A Vision for You if I put it up on the screen?
I'd be happy to. A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, Leanne. Thank everybody for everything, all of you. Larry for wrangling the questions, home group members, Marilyn, of course. I'm going to remove the, I'm going to allow people to unmute. Let me just click that. And I would invite everyone to just, let's just have a moment of silence and static filled, confusing, resonant version of the Lord's Prayer. Thank you. Our Father.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Oh, thank you so much, Marilyn.
Thank you, Marilyn. Am I unmuted? Yes. It's been a wonderful visit, but I have a 5:30 meeting.